You're listening to What the Hell is Michael Jammin Talking About? Conversations in writing, art, and creativity. Today's episode is brought to you by my debut collection of true stories, A Paper Orchestra, available in print, ebook, and audiobook. To purchase and to support me and this podcast, please visit michaeljammin.com/book. And now, on with the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of What the Hell is Michael Jammin Talking About? Well, we're doing another Q&A from one of our webinars, and my special guest host is Kevin Lewandowski, script coordinator extraordinaire. He helps out with a lot of my projects, social media projects here, and he's subbing in for Phil, and he's doing a great job. So welcome, Kevin.
Thank you again for having me.
You screwed it up. You already screwed. No, I'm only messing with you. You're doing great.
Thanks. I'm not going to apologize for not being Phil anymore. So
no.
Sorry, Phil. I'm happy to be here. And this how professional screenwriters overcome writer's block is one of my favorite topics to talk about.
Okay.
So I think it's super, super interesting. And there's been when we dive into it, I'll say my favorite line that you always say unlocked the excuse sometimes we use for when we have writer's block. So
I'm curious to know what your favorite line is.
I have so many Michael Jaminisms that I think my all-time favorite is shit happening is not a story.
By the way, we have that on merch now, guys. We have
we
got merch, and you can go get it at michaeljammin.com/merch, where all the crazy things that I say, you can get it on a t-shirt, on a mug, or a notebook, or whatever. We got merch. Go get it. I should have plugged it before, but I forgot. But anyway, these questions came from our last webinar that we did. And if you're not on my webinar list, sign up for it. It's free. Go to michaeljammin.com/webinar and you can sign up. You can be invited when we do our next one. And so, yeah, Kevin, we had a lot of questions people asked. We didn't have time to get all the questions answered. And so here they are now.
Here we go. These first couple questions are going to be about kind of course-related stuff. So this first one is from David Salzillo. I feel like we see his name a lot. I feel like he comes to these webinars a lot and asks a lot of questions. The question is, how does the story structure change when, say, a character does not or cannot achieve a goal, like in the tragic story, for example?
Doesn't change at all. It's the same old story structure that we use. Whether the character achieves their goal at the end or not, it's the same damn thing.
Yep.
He's just asking at the end, like, what if the last 2 minutes are different? So what? Nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's always more interesting for me when like that character doesn't achieve their goal. You know, they like, I think, the breakup with, Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston, like,
yeah,
they don't stay together in the end.
No.
It's one of the few rom-coms that,
yeah,
you know, I think, they decide to go off the beaten path and not have.
Often
them
we call this the joyful defeat in a movie, or, you know, the character doesn't get what they want, but they get what they need.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next question, Rob Robert. When is the latest the stakes should be made clear?
The sooner the better, because the story does not start until the audience knows what's at stake. And so until then, you're boring them, and you're daring them to change the channel or read another script or do something else with their time. So the sooner the better.
Yep.
And that's a note you'll get from a network executive. They'll always say, can we start the story sooner? And so wherever you have it, they'll give you that note.
Yeah.
If it's on page 4, they'll say page 2. So,
in your experience, is there like a realistic, like, you know, for instance, if they were like, oh, it's on page 3, like we need it on page 2. Have you ever run into like, we just can't, like we need a little bit of room to be able to.
Oh yeah.
To set something up.
Absolutely. And so you'll move it up a little bit, but there's only so much you can do.
Yeah. But yeah, like you said, they'll always say, oh, can we start this sooner? Yeah. We'll take a look at it. We'll take a look at that.
We'll do.
Coley Marie, can the goal change or appear to change?
Yes. And often, it sometimes will. It's like, you know, because something happens, and then what the character thought they wanted is not what they want anymore.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Yeah. So how do you feel about, you know, because sometimes it's, is there a fear of like, if you start writing it too much of a change, can it almost feel like, oh, okay, now we're following a different story?
It usually happens kind of like at top of Act Three, where the character discovers, you know, this thing that I wanted turns out I don't really want any.
Right.
I got what I had. Right. I got what I thought I wanted, and it's not what I want.
Yeah.
So that's usually late in the script.
Yeah. So you're saying like in top of Act Two, you know, if they wanted to,
it wouldn't be top
ride a pony at the end of Act One. Top of Act Two shouldn't be like, well, I want to win this prize at the carnival now.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Now they top of Act Two is when they, well, this is what we teach in the course, what top of Act Two would be. Yep. So, yeah.
Jadarius Kennedy. So should we avoid high stakes conflicts?
No, the higher stakes are good. High stakes are good.
Yeah.
Higher the stakes, the better. You don't want to avoid low stakes conflicts.
Yeah. Low stakes conflicts are not that interesting.
Yeah.
Heather Marie Vitale. How do we find conflicts for TV shows with main characters without getting stale? I think that's kind of the job of a writer.
Yeah, that's right. That's the job. Without getting stale, it's like, you know, and again, this is not your concern. Your concern is to do it once.
Yeah.
And then let the showrunner worry about it getting stale. Right now, your job is to write one great script.
Yeah. Ari Berry. When it comes to an episodic show, there's the overall show conflict and then the mini conflicts of the episodes. So I'm assuming they're talking about there's the A story, the B story, the C story.
Or maybe they're talking about the overall arch of the show. Like I'm watching Shogun right now.
Yeah.
So, and I'm only on episode one. So it seems like the overarching story is like, how's this one, I don't know if we call it the feudal lord going to maintain his position in the kingdom.
Yeah.
But within each episode, he has a challenge that he has to overcome. So to make that larger goal happen.
Meg Parker Wilson, when you are writing a TV show, do you plot out the entire story, pilot to finale, and then create all those moments episode by episode in terms of the arc and the structure?
No. It's too much work. It's too difficult.
Yeah.
You know what you really, and again, this is not something that she needs to worry about, but maybe she's just asking me out of curiosity.
Yeah.
We're just, you know, we'll come up with a pilot and we'll have that pilot broken. We know what that story is going to be. Mm-hmm. And then we have a vague idea of what season one might be, but I'm talking mm-hmm. vague, just enough to bullshit our way through this, because it'll change when we're breaking the stories. As we discover writing and digging into the character, we'll discover something that might be better. And so what are we going to do? Not do it just because we said we were talking out of our ass that this other thing was going to be better.
Right. Yeah. I think Vince Gilligan, creator of Breaking Bad,
right.
You know, I think he says something very similar, like, yeah, we kind of have an idea, but you know, part of going through different story ideas is you discover stuff along the way. Like Jesse Pinkman was only supposed to be 4 or 5 episodes.
Yeah.
And then now it's, you know, they realize how much, you know, chemistry those two characters mm-hmm. had. And, you know, could you imagine, you know, would that show have worked if they would have killed off Jesse Pinkman? Because they said, well, we said in our pitch, we have to kill him off after 5 episodes.
Yeah.
We have to stick with that. So
I'm always surprised that people don't know that. And they're worried about breaking the entire series. And it's like, but it's so breaking one episode of television. When I'm talking breaking, figuring out what the story is and writing the outline of the script is so much work. How could you possibly do all that in advance? It's like, and you have a team of writers doing all that work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, sometimes you'll see people that all talk about like, you know, I have this TV series I wrote and I have, you know, the first 8 episodes done. And I'm like, oh, that's a lot to do with.
Yeah. No, they don't.
You know, one person.
They really don't. They might have enough for one episode and they broke it up into 8 episodes because they don't know any better. That's very common, I think.
I remember there's another example on Friends that one of the writers was talking about. It's, you know, it's probably one of the more iconic moments of the whole series is when, you know, Ross is getting married to Emily mm-hmm. and Rachel shows up and he accidentally says Rachel's name, you know, I Ross take thee Rachel. And the writer was saying like, that wasn't anything we would have ever thought of. It was one day we were rehearsing mm-hmm. or something like that. And he accidentally said the wrong name. And as writers, we all laughed. And we thought that's super funny. And he was like, we had the aha moment of like, oh, we need to include this. And like that little moment had so much of a change for the rest of the series because now it, you know, turned into Well, Emily will make them, you know, now, okay, it's clear that Ross is still in love with Rachel, and Emily, you know, she's only going to come to New York if Ross stops talking to Rachel. So it was just that little moment of discovery. And, you know, if it had, you know, what would that scene or storyline have been if, Ross married Emily? Okay. Right.
Cool. Like, and they discovered that by accident and rehearsal. Right. And what are you going to do? Not do with this. And that moment, like, everyone gasped in the audience and people at home gasped.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What are you not going to do it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think, like, in their pitch, they're like, okay, season 5, we're going to have Ross marry this British girl, but when he's actually up there, we're going to have him say Rachel's name. Like, that was just the discovery.
You don't think that far in advance. You can't. Yeah. Too much work.
Let's see. So this next question from Sarah, there's a bit of terminology from your course, so I'm going to not use that terminology, but does the end of Act 2 have to be in direct relation to the conflict with the introduced in the first act? Can it be attributed to a different relationship conflict?
No. You're telling, pretty much no. You're telling one story. That's your A story. You want your Act 2 break to be on the A story. Not if it's coming out of nowhere and it's like, what's this? It's not going to feel earned. It's going to be like, what's going on?
Yep. Rob Robert again. How do we make funny because it can be so subjective?
Yeah. How do you make, you know, one thing I say is in my course, I can't teach you how to be funny. I can maybe teach you how to be a little funnier. You know, I could give you tips that will help you be a little funnier, but if you're not funny, I can't help you be funny.
No.
And it's okay. You don't have to, you can write drama. There's plenty of work for drama writers.
No.
And just write what you're really good at, you know, but it is a little heartbreaking. I see sometimes when people want to be a commentator, but you're not funny. So this is, but you don't have that in you. That's okay. Yeah. Write some other stuff. Drama's great too.
Yeah. One of my other favorite things you say, and this wasn't the one I was talking about earlier, is you have to find new ways to say old things in a funny way. Because every version of a joke has been told to a degree. So how do you make it relevant to today and your story and your characters and make it so it hasn't been heard that way before?
You know what, though? I just got an email from I don't know how I'm on this list, whatever. I got an email from a writer, and she's doing a public appearance. And she said, come see me, the headline, come see me, I don't bite. And I'm like, oh God, like, that's like you're supposed to be a writer. Don't tell me you don't bite. That's so unoriginal. That's so clammy. That's not something a writer should ever say. Find a new way to say, I don't bite.
Yeah.
I was so unimpressed. I was like, oh God, you just embarrass yourself. Don't do that. You're a writer. You have to find a new way to say old things.
Yeah. Okay. So these are kind of more craft related questions. Nathan Shapiro.
Yeah.
What are the rookie mistakes you see new writers making, both in writing as well as from the business side? What is something you wish you had known when you were starting out? And then part two, which I think this is actually part three, do all supporting lead characters need an obstacle and goal, or is it sufficient that they're simply there to facilitate the main hero's journey?
This guy's got questions.
We'll split this up. So the first part was, what are the rookie mistakes you see new writers making, both in writing as well as from the business side?
I mean, a rookie mistake in the writer's room is what we call when they bitch instead of pitch. The expression is pitch, don't bitch. So it's very easy for a new writer to shoot down an idea in the room without having a better one, because it's hard to come up with a better one. So that's a rookie thing. I don't care if the idea on the table is bad. If you don't have a better one, shut up, because it's, you know, what are you there for? You're not a critic. What your job is to make it better, not to say this is bad.
No.
So,
and also don't defend your joke if the showrunner doesn't think it's good.
Yeah.
If you pitch something, they're like, I don't really know. Okay, that's it.
Yeah. Don't
fight
it again.
For it. Don't.
Yeah.
Just let it go. Think of a better one.
What was the other question?
So the next one is, what is something you wish you had known when you were starting out?
Well, to be honest, everything that I teach in the course, I didn't know any of it.
Yeah.
So,
I think it's just, Michael's course has unlocked a lot for me, and someone that's not a very intelligent person, he really simplifies it and
Make it easy.
It's easy to understand because I'm not I don't understand the terminology of progressive complications, inciting incidents, all that stuff.
Like, I don't understand it either. So
any sense to me? I won't tell you what the terms are that Michael uses. You'll have to take his course, but they're much easier to understand.
I think writing should be simple. It's not easy, but it's simple.
Yeah. And then the last part of this question, do all supporting lead characters need an obstacle and goal, or is it sufficient that they're simply there to facilitate the main hero's journey?
Often they are an obstacle in the main hero's journey. Sometimes if you don't give them too much to play, they can be the Greek chorus, but generally every character in a scene has to have an attitude on something. And if they don't, why are they in the scene? If they don't have, they're not just there to stand around.
Yeah.
So
do you also think when in the context of like the story structure you teach in your class, those, you know, B stories that aren't necessarily as emotionally empowering mm-hmm. as what the A story is, do you think it should still follow all those structure points or just enough, or, you know, does it really matter?
No, a B story doesn't carry the same emotional weight as the A story. Yeah. So it doesn't have to be structured the way an A story is, but stuff does have to happen and it doesn't have to, can't be random. It has to be on that story that we're following.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, next question. If it's an ensemble cast like Orange is the New Black or Stranger Things, mm-hmm. does each character have to have a stake or only a main character? So very similar to this question.
Yeah, usually you're following. I mean, I haven't watched Stranger Things in a long time. Maybe they have two or three running storylines in each episode. I don't know. They probably do.
Who is the hero in horror movies like Friday the 13th? Is it Jason or the person who survives at the end?
Well, you're not rooting for Jason. You're not rooting for him to murder everybody. So, and again, I haven't seen those Friday the 13th movies, but you're rooting for the person, who's in the summer camp,
Michael, is there such thing as an anti-hero?
Yeah, of course there is. And I talk about that, but the problem is, I think it's unnecessarily complicated. What's the difference between an anti-hero and a hero? Why don't you just call it a hero and make it easier on yourself? Oh, because your anti-hero is a little bit unlikable or a little bit, dirty or villainous. Yeah. Well, that's okay. They're still a hero.
Yeah.
I
think there's an example you used of, if you're writing something about the devil, him being, what we all think the devil is, like, that's not interesting. You make him where he has compassion with some things, and you give him layers, like Sopranos. You talk about that example as well, and I think it's that those villains they're the hero in their own story. We may not agree with it. They're the hero in their own story, though.
Yeah, I think Tony Soprano, I don't think he's an anti-hero. I think he's a hero.
Okay, next question. Do you have to know the end when you start the story? Can it change?
Often it does, but usually when we're breaking a story on the board in the writer's room, no one's sent off to outline or script until we know what the ending is. But it's not uncommon to get a draft back and you go, this ending isn't working. Let's figure out a new act three,
Yeah. In your experience, do you think like the ending doesn't feel right? Do you think that was potentially because it wasn't broken in the best way?
Yeah.
Or do you think the writer didn't maybe necessarily deliver the dialogue the right way?
Well, often problems in act three require solutions in act one.
Yeah.
So it's not, in other words, it wasn't set up right. The ending wasn't set up early. And so you it's unusual to say, okay, all we have to do is fix act three. You got to fix all of it.
Yeah. And that's when you have the really late nights and you do dinner in the writer's room, which everyone hates when that PA comes around and is, all right, what does everyone want for dinner?
Yep.
You are listening to What the Hell is Michael Jammin Talking About? Today's episode is brought to you by my new book, A Paper Orchestra, A Collection of True Stories. John Mayer says it's fantastic. It's multi-timbral. It runs all levels of the pyramid at the same time. His knockout punches are stinging sincerity. And Kirkus Review says, those who appreciate the power of simple stories to tell us about human nature or who are bewitched by a storyteller who has mastered his craft will find a delightful collection of vignettes, a lovely anthology that strikes a perfect balance between humor and poignancy. So, you know, my podcast is not advertiser supported. I'm not running ads here. So if you'd like to support me or the podcast, come check out my book. Go get it in an ebook or a paperback. Or if you really want to treat yourself, check out the audiobook. Go to michaeljammin.com/book. And now back to our show.
From Rachel, it helps to do homework before even writing. Yes. Like if you're new to fantasy, read some fantasy scripts or books first.
Sure. A lot, as much as you can. So. Yeah. And but I'd also ask you why you want to write fantasy then if you've never read any or what's attracting to you if you don't even know anything about it.
Yeah. Next question. What's with the job titles that writers end up with? What do the different kinds of jobs actually cover?
So there's different levels to writers. They're just ranks in terms of how much. It's like pay grades, basically. So the lowest level writer is called a staff writer, even though it's confusing because every writer on staff is a staff writer, but the lowest level writer has the title of staff writer. Then the next higher up is called story editor, then executive story editor, then co-producer, producer, supervising producer, co-executive producer, executive producer. The executive producer is the showrunner.
Yep.
And so they're the boss. And everyone else, they're just different levels. They turn, you know, that determines how much you're going to get paid. Often it determines how much responsibility you have. If the showrunner leaves the room, often it's the co-executive producer who will run the room in their proxy, or they'll go to they'll do the set. They'll go, you know, work on the set. They'll do whatever. That's based on their experience. And, but, you know, in terms of job responsibilities, other than that, it's really up to the showrunner to determine how much they want. Like maybe they'll say if someone's a producer, they may let them go to the set on their own. I mean, it just depends on the showrunner, what they want them to do.
Yeah. One of the shows I worked on, I think we talked about this in the last podcast, Steve Rudnick, who wrote Space Jam and Santa Claus movies. He was a supervising producer on the Muppets and he spent a lot of time on set. And he really liked it. It's just fascinating to watch how those puppeteers can do their stuff.
Yeah.
Next question from Steven. Can stream of consciousness work for screenwriting?
Sounds terrible to me. I'm not a fan of stream of consciousness. It's like, I'm not really interested in reading your thoughts.
Yeah.
If you're going to take me someplace, take me by the hand and lead me there. Just going to say it right now, I feel stream of consciousness is masturbatory. I feel like it's for yourself and no one else. But, you know, someone else may enjoy it.
Yeah. So when you say, you know, hold my hand, you know, because I think there's also this, people sometimes assume, well, like, well, I don't want to put that on the page because it's going to take a page. Like the audience will get it. Like the audience will understand what I'm going for. And I think, you know, is there that fine line of like figuring out, okay, what do I need to hold the hand of the audience through versus what do I think they're going to be able to pick up?
I like to write when I'm writing, I like to check in with the audience, let them know. When I say hold their hand, like let them know, remind them what's at stake here, what this character wants. I'd like to just check. So it's not a mystery. Now, often that's the difference between, you know, sometimes you'll see a really smart writing. They won't kind of do that. They expect a little more of the audience. It just depends on what kind of show you're doing. If you're doing a broad, silly show, you check in with the audience knowing that that's not what they're there for. They're there for something silly and fun. You got to keep checking in with them. But I just saw Zone of Interest, which is really smart. And they didn't check in with the audience. Yeah. And that might win the Oscar. It's a wonderful movie. Also, that's not a movie for the masses. You know, it's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be a movie that's a blockbuster. It was a great movie though.
Yeah.
So, you know.
What are the stakes of 2001, A Space Odyssey?
Oh, God, I haven't seen it in forever. I mean, what were the stakes? Was the guy, I'm trying to remember, they went on a spaceship, they had a mission, but then the computer was sabotaging the mission And there was going to basically, I think the computer was going to kill them, basically, taking on a mission that would kill them. Is that right? I think, is that I remember. So the stakes were life or death.
Yeah, right? Those are pretty big stakes.
Yeah, and how do we defeat the computer who's the boss of the whole thing? How do we fool the computer?
Yeah.
I believe that's what it was, right? It was a long time ago.
It's been a while since I've seen that. And I guess if they don't, they die.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next question. How would you recommend doing a man versus a system conflict, like perhaps a scene in Cool Hand Luke?
Well, I mean, that was the whole thing. He wanted to get out of prison. They were trying to, and again, I haven't seen that in 10, 12 years. I don't remember. He was in prison and he was trying to, the system was trying to break him down. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, that's like anything. You escape from Alcatraz is the same thing. How do we get out of this prison?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember in Cool Hand Luke, there was probably a face to the system. It wasn't like a system. It was like,
right.
I'm guessing it was, there was a warden or something,
yeah.
Or there are other inmates who were his, who was the face of the system. Because, I'm trying to remember it. So they caught me off guard.
Yeah. So I was thinking about when you said, I was thinking Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
And, I think it's, there's the system, but then, kind of the warden represents, the system in that context.
There was the warden and then the warden's proxy, the guard.
Right.
And there were definitely, it wasn't so much the system. It was, they were faces of the system.
Yeah. Okay. Can the conflict be hidden from the hero? Like the hero thinks they want control, money, but they really don't want to be alone because they were abandoned as a kid.
Well, I mean, all of that is fine, but the hero is not, your hero is not going to want to, a hero wanting money is like not a rootable goal. Who cares? Yeah. So what your hero wants, it sounds like is companionship, if they're abandoned or their self-worth or whatever, that's what they're really wanting. So, all of that is fine, but I'm not sure why it's not hidden for the,
I think Breaking Bad. Yeah, I think a lot of people would think, well, Walter White wanted money. That's
no, it's not what he wanted. Walter White wanted to provide for his family because he was going to be dead soon. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the money he wanted. Yeah. What he wanted was very rootable. He wants to give his family, something to so they can live when he's dead to because he can't provide for them.
Yep.
So it wasn't like he wanted a new Ferrari.
Yeah. And then I think that slightly eventually morphed into he just wants to maintain being powerful.
Then it turned into something else. Then he went down this path of it was about power and control and he went down that but that was only seasons into it.
Yeah. Is AI an equalizer for skill and creativity in this competitive era of artists?
I don't think so. I think AI, I guess it's a cheat code. I mean, like if you want to be a writer, if you wanted to be a race car driver, you'd learn how to race car drive.
Right.
And you'd go to courses and classes and you'd be really good at shifting and all that stuff and understand the apex of a curve and how to attack a curve. Or I suppose you could get behind the wheel of a Tesla and put it on autopilot and you could just fall asleep. But why do you want to be a race car driver then? If that's what you aspire to do, do you just want to be a dummy in the wheel of the car?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
I think one of the other things you always say too is you don't, I don't, AI may never be able to like write true human emotion and never be able to really write like what my personal stories have been in my life. And I think until it can do that, I think we're fine.
Yeah. I mean, I we'll see. I mean, they're doing some, I guess, crazy, amazing things. And I don't know. We'll see. But I'm not sure. I don't know why you or any other aspiring writer would want that. I would think you would want to root against that.
Oh, like, yeah.
I think, don't you want to write story? Don't you want to be the author of the stories? Isn't that why you want to be a writer? To take what's inside of you and express it in a way that entertains people? Or do you want to be just the person who plugs a computer in the morning?
Yeah.
And say you're a writer.
Yeah. And, you know, I think about like, you know, the writer's strike we all went through, and, you know, that was a huge topic of conversation. And, you know, writers took a sacrifice to stop this from happening, to help protect, you know, writers that are going to be coming up. And, you know, I think it's probably going to be an ongoing battle for a while.
Yeah. The world's changing fast.
Yeah.
It's scary.
Yeah. Too fast.
Yeah, too fast.
Is it possible to have two showrunners attached to one project, the creator of the show and one more experienced showrunner?
No. I mean, they're not going to be equal. I mean, I suppose anything's possible, but it's very unlikely. Mm-hmm. I've been on shows where a younger writer created it and then they assigned a showrunner. And the showrunner, you know, on that one show, the showrunner was very gracious and he included this young writer in a lot of the decisions. And it wasn't he made it, you know, a partnership as best as he could. But at the end of the day, he was still the boss. Someone has to be the boss. So,
yeah,
you know, but he was very gracious about how he treated this young writer. And, you know, he really wanted to mentor him.
Yeah.
But again, when you're a mentor, that means you know more than the other person.
Right. And you and Sievert have run shows together, right?
Yeah, but we're a partnership, so that's a little different. Yeah. But this person's talking about one person created another one's. Like, again, everyone wants to be a showrunner, which is, again, like, why? It's so freaking hard. I want to make all the decisions, but you don't know, based on what? You don't know what you're doing. Like, right. Why would you want that? Like, is it an ego thing? You want to tell people you're a showrunner? Or like, don't you want to learn? Do you assume? When I was starting off, I didn't want to be a showrunner. For 10 years, I didn't want to be a showrunner. Like, this is a hard job. I don't know how to do it.
Yep.
And then you get to the point in your career where it's like, it's either that or unemployment. So I'm like, all right, sign me up for showrunner.
Yep. Well, even with that, you know, I, you know, the rooms I've been in, you just see how many meetings that the showrunners have to be in that aren't necessarily directly related to the writing and the story. Mm-hmm. It's costume stuff. It's hair and makeup stuff. It's, you know, set pieces. It's all these different things that they have the,
yeah,
final approval on. And
yeah. I mean, and that's the easy part, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Breaking in, any advice for being hired in a writer's room without coming up with an original show idea, or do you have to bring an original idea to an interview?
No, you don't have to. You can write a script on an existing show. You can write a great Game of Thrones spec script. And as long as the showrunner wants to read it and thinks it's great, you're hired.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, in today's world, from what I've heard, you know, spec scripts sort of aren't really a thing anymore.
Yeah.
Do you think a lot of that has to do with just because there's, you know, so much out there that, you know, I could, you know, if I'm like, here, Michael, here's a spec on whatever show, there's a real chance that I've never heard of the show.
Yes, that's exactly. And that's why I think it's unfair. Life is unfair, but that's why I think it's harder today than it was back when I was breaking in, because you could write a spec script on an existing show on ER and everyone knew what ER was.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting too, because then, you know, I've heard you say this too before, like, you know, if you're running whatever show and, you know, it's in season two or season three, and, you know, you're interviewing me and you read my original pilot, you know, you're more like, well, this is great, but I want to know, can you write my show? Like, that's what I want you for. Like, your original pilot is cool, has nothing to do with my show. Like, I want to know, can you write my show? Can you, you know, do you have the characters' personalities down?
Right.
No.
Yeah. It's hard, and it's harder to create an original show, a pilot. It's much harder, I feel, than creating a spec script of an existing show. But
yeah,
that's the days we live in. What are we going to do?
Yeah. I think that might have been all of our questions for right now. But I did want to say, so the one thing I always take away when, you know, we talk about this is, you know, when writers overcome writer's block, you know, something you always say is writer's block isn't really a thing. For professional writers, you don't get to say, I'm going to go to the beach for 3 days and clear my head. You know, and if you're really struggling with the writer's block, chances are you don't necessarily have the structure down to a point, and that'll help unlock a lot of problems for you. And that's, you know, what Michael Scorch teaches is, you know, those structure points and what you need to know. And, you know, I think there's, you know, little instances of writer's block where, you know, if I'm just kind of like, I'm a little frustrated, go for a walk. You know, for 15-20 minutes. And you know, I live by a mall here in Glendale, and it wasn't too long ago. I remember I was walking, and I was just, you know, thinking about something. I saw these two people, and it looked like it was a boyfriend and a girlfriend, and she had her Starbucks and she was taking a picture of it, and like someone bumped into her and she dropped it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I just happened to see this interaction, and the guy, his reaction was kind of like, well, and I thought that was so fascinating, because I was like, okay, what's the relationship between these two people? Because this is definitely not a first date, because if it was a first date, he'd be like, oh my gosh, like, let me go get you a new one.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, okay, so have they been dating for a while? Okay, then it's like, okay, well, if that was his reaction, has this happened so many times? He's just sick of her shit.
Yes.
Like always posting it to Instagram. He's like, I told you this was going to happen.
Right.
And then like, I start kind of like building this story in my head of like, what if this is her moment where she's like, I'm going to break up with you. Like, this is bullshit. Like, you're laughing at something bad that happened to me.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, I remember coming back to, you know, my apartment that day, and I felt like more just kind of relaxed and calm, because I saw this like live event unfold that I don't think anyone else was watching, but I just happened to see this unfold. And I don't think that was anything I could have, you know, really written, because I think I would have wrote like, oh, she drops it, he picks it up because he wants to impress her, because he wants to get laid later. But his reaction was like, yeah, I told, like, this shit happens all the time. Like, stop taking pictures, just drink the damn coffee.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. You're observing. That's what you should be doing.
Yeah.
It's good.
And when I worked at a theme park, get a lot of material there from people, a lot of different personalities. I used to jot down a lot of stuff I used to see, and just how people would interact. And it's nice to, you know, when you kind of feel those moments of writing and you're kind of stuck, you know, go back to those notes you took, and that can help unlock something. I know you always show on your webinars, you have your, you know, black notebook that you've been carrying around your entire career, and you know, things people have taught you along the way, and you write them down in there, and you know, that's gold right there.
Yeah, write it down. Keep a list of your, like what you're saying, just those specific things are just interesting.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah,
and because you always say too, like, when you're driving, you don't really listen to the radio or anything, you just kind of talk notes on your phone, just to kind of get it out there and start thinking about it. And
yeah, if I'm working on a story, I won't listen to the radio. I'll just obsess over this one moment I'm trying to fix in the story.
Yeah.
And if I get it, great. Now I can, that was my writing for that morning, was, you know, fixing that one problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, Kevin, that is all we have question wise, Michael.
We did it.
We did it.
We did it. Thank you, everyone. What else we got to talk about? If you want to come to our free screenwriting webinars, you can sign up at michaeljammin.com/webinar.
Yep.
If you'd like to, I got a newsletter, get on that, michaeljammin.com/newsletter. And of course, I'm plugging my book, which I worked on for 4.5 years. It's called The Paper Orchestra. And it asks the question, what if it's the smallest, almost forgotten moments that are the ones that shape us most? And someone asked me on the live if I could explain it a little better, what it is. And I think with the book, one way to explain it is, imagine it's a very personal and intimate stories, and I'm sharing them as if, imagine like me reading my diary, but performing it out loud, knowing that you are going to be watching it. And so I'm going to say it in a way that's going to be entertain you, but it's still my diary, but it's structured in a way, so it's like, I know I have an audience here. And so that's kind of what it is. They're stories, they're true stories, but hopefully they're told in a way that is engaging and makes you laugh, and hopefully makes you feel something. It's more importantly.
Yeah. So go to michaeljammin.com, check out his book. There's a bunch of, just go to his website, michaeljammin.com, click around. There's webinars, there's, you know, the podcast get uploaded there. You know, there's a couple of free lessons. You can download scripts he's written. There's so much there. And yeah, like you said, that you can get his book there, and you can get a signed copy from him on his website. And it's Amazon. It was, you know, when you originally launched it, it was number one in like 5 different categories on Amazon.
Nuts.
So it was pretty wild. So yeah, check out the book, join the class, join our webinars, follow Michael on social media. He's still giving out free tips and trying to help people. And yeah, that's all I got.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, Kevin. Great job. And if they want to follow you, Kevin, on where do they follow you on social media?
Yeah. So it's Kevin_Lewandowski. It's a long last name. I'm sure after you just type the first 5 letters, it'll pop up.
Excellent. All right, everyone. Until next week, keep writing.
Wow, I did it again. Another fantastic episode of What the Hell is Michael Jammin Talking About? How do I do it week after week? Well, I don't do it with advertiser-supported money. I tell you how I do it. I do it with my book. If you'd like to support the show, if you'd like to support me, go check out my new book, A Paper Orchestra. It asks the question, what if it's the smallest, almost forgotten moments that are the ones that shape us most? Laura Sanjagoma says, good storytelling also leads us to ourselves, our memories, our beliefs, personal and powerful. I loved the journey. And Max Muchnick, who was on my show, says, as the father of daughters, I found Michael's understanding of parenting and the human condition to be spot on. This book is a fantastic read. Go check it out for yourself. Go to michaeljammin.com/book. Thank you all, and stay tuned. More great stuff coming next week.